Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. My guest today is Dr. Brian Swim, who is a mathematical cosmologist on the graduate faculty of the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. He received his PhD from University of Oregon, specializing in gravitational dynamics, mathematical cosmology, and singularity theory. His research focuses on the evolutionary dynamics of the universe, the relationship between scientific cosmology and more traditional religious visions, the cultural implications of the new evolutionary epic, and the role of humanity in the unfolding story of the Earth and cosmos. He has numerous books, The Heart of the Hidden Cosmos, Manifestation of a Global Civilization with Matthew Fox, The Universe is a Green Dragon, and The Universe Story, which he did with Thomas Berry. Also a number of video series, the latest of which is The Earth's Imagination. Brian, welcome to Conversations.
Great to be here, Michael.
Good to have you on. I've been looking forward to this. I was saying to you earlier, it's like I got dropped into a candy factory with 1,000 rooms and 50 minutes to talk about it. You know, a lot of people probably don't even know what cosmology is. Why don't you tell us why cosmological evolution is important for us and what it is, and a little bit about the emerging story?
I would love to. I should say, first of all, cosmology doesn't necessarily refer to lipstick. Okay, that's cosmetology, although I'm often confused. Cosmology, it's a great word because it belongs in both the sciences and the humanities. From the scientific point of view, it's a study of the birth and the development of the physical universe. But from the point of view of philosophy and religion and literature, cosmology is about the meaning of the human in the universe, like what is the purpose of life. And I love that. It's one of the few words we have that lives in both sciences and humanities. So I'm trying to actually be true to both meanings. I'm trying to understand the universe as we've discovered it in our careful observations and calculations in the sciences, and yet always wondering with a whole long lineage of thinkers about what this means for us today. What does it mean to be human in this universe that we find ourselves in?
That's a great question, because there is an enormous story that's emerging. You and Thomas Berry, of course, have been real pioneers in that. Joanna Macy, David Corton, others who have been on this show, we're talking about this emerging story. Tell us, if you can, in kind of a capsulated version of what is the new story that's emerging?
The new story is the realization that we find ourselves in this immense universe with maybe 100 billion galaxies, and all of this was just a little tiny dot, smaller than a grain of sand, 14 billion years ago. It's a realization that everything we see about us actually developed into that form, that we began very simply, just we began as this intense heat, and then we unfolded and complexified, and then here we are. It's the discovery that the universe is not a place, it's not just matter and energy. The universe, in some fundamental way, is story. It's an energy that is going somewhere. I would say that's the new story we're discovering.
The impact of this story, I mean, it's a story that that can include all cultures, all races, and for the most part, all religions, although I did a symposium last week with some pretty staunch creationists, and I couldn't quite see how to fit 6,000 years into 14 billion, but still, it's a challenge. I'm sure you've probably done better than I have.
Yeah.
But say a little bit about the impact, and when we look at this emergence, this incredible relationship to the Earth and to the universe of 14 billion years, and how everything that happened at that initial explosion, we're all a part of.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so amazing.
It is so amazing. We're just discovering it, really. So, especially in light of people that have questions about this and maybe even arguments, I just think it's important for us to say that we're just discovering this. And in terms of our long-term history on this planet, it's so new, so fresh, and it's overwhelmingly beautiful. And I think part of the thrill for me is that there's so much yet to learn. So I try to remind myself and everyone that the only attitude that really works is one of humility. We're just wading into this vast new story. You know, you right away brought out one of the most important implications, and that is it's a common story. Even though there are arguments and so forth, it's common in the sense that it's not coming from any one tradition. It's not like a particular culture or religion gave birth to this. And this hit me in graduate school very powerfully. One night we're just sitting there and having this conversation about stars and how they exploded. And then out of those explosions, our bodies ultimately were formed. And we were just marveling over this. And it hit me at one moment that this guy over here was from Iran, and he was a Muslim. And this guy over here was from Russia, you know, and he was a secular Marxist. And my own background is in Catholicism. And this other guy over here was from China, and he really had a Taoist kind of bent. And I just thought, it doesn't matter. No matter what part of the planet we come from, we're discovering this amazing sequence of events that preceded us. And here we are, we're thinking about this, and we're discussing it. And then what flickers into consciousness every now and then is that this energy that we're talking about that gave birth to the stars, let's say, or that exploded into the elements, this energy is what we are. It's just an amazing rush. When that hits you, you realize that you're thinking about this energy, but you are this energy thinking about it. And then there's a way in which you discover a commonality, because everybody in the conversation is also this energy. And you just feel yourself slip into, really, another form of consciousness. And it's something about the unitive nature that you brought up, Michael. It's this realization that we have this in common, and that we are a one energy event taking place.
Well, recently we've had some very positive things happening around the world, but for the most part, there's a very large undercurrent of despair, of people feeling that something's not right. And if you really go a little deeper, you can see that there are a lot of things, you know, the nexus of peak oil, environmental degradation and resource depletion and climate change and all of these different things. But there's something that really gives you hope, and beyond hope, the realization that we have this place, what's it called, the Baldwin effect, that we actually are involved in evolutionary change in a very basic and dynamic way. Can you talk about that, the human's role in the evolutionary change?
That's part of the kind of thrill of realizing that we're not just talking about evolutionary dynamics out there, but in fact, we are these evolutionary dynamics. That's the kind of switch. There are a variety of changes that are taking place, and one of them is a movement out of this dualism of kind of us over here talking about nature over there, and then moving into this non-dual way of understanding it. And most powerfully, in terms of what you are pointing to, Michael, and that is that the evolutionary dynamics are unfurling through us. That's the great revelation that's taking place. There are different ways of saying it, but one way would be to start with the first part of your sentence, and that was the difficulties we face. And I think many people now that have looked at the situation carefully have come to the same conclusion, that we are living in the worst moment of of the last 65 million years. I mean, I'm laughing because it's just, God, what a time to wake up in the universe. But, you know, if we look at the Earth from the point of view of biology, it's never been this bad in terms of the destruction of life. People were beginning to suspect this in the 1980s. And then by the 1990s, biologists were pretty convinced that this was really the biggest disaster.
Well, I think the majority of biologists now say that we're moving into the sixth mass extinction, and it hasn't happened for, 65 million years, something like this.
Exactly. It's certainly the worst moment in 65 million years, but some biologists even claim that there's been nothing this bad in 4 billion years of life. So, I mean, it's so easy to become overwhelmed by this. But actually, if we reflect on the disaster and try to understand it, there's a secret dimension of hope in the midst of that. And that is that to understand what led to this disaster, there are a lot of reasons, a lot of causes. But the way I'd like to highlight here is that the human became so powerful that we could no longer see ourselves as just another species on the planet, but we had to realize and have to realize that we are actually something like a planetary dimension. We're something like a power that is on a equal basis with the atmosphere. I mean, one way to see this is to look at the atmosphere and to calculate how much we are affecting it. We are affecting the atmosphere as much as all the rest of life put together. It's amazing. I mean, life has been here for 4 billion years and has been involved with the atmosphere all that time. It has a huge impact on the atmosphere. The atmosphere and the biosphere both are involved with each other. And then the human comes along, and in just a single generation or two, our impact in terms of just if you look at carbon, our impact in terms of carbon is over 100% larger than the rest of the biosphere put together. And then, so the question has to be, how did this happen? What led to this? And one way to understand it is that we invented language. With language, we found a way to become more powerful even than the dynamics of natural selection, because we could keep building up our insights. And so the knowledge base of the human grew kind of like a coral reef. With every generation, it got bigger and bigger. And so in time, we actually could work our way around all of the different species. But the problem was, so we had the power of all of this past history on the planet. We had all this power, but we were attempting to organize in it using a cultural wisdom that was too small. So that our great challenge now is to develop a cultural wisdom that will enable us to manage power that is at the level of an entire planet. You see, this is what I mean in terms of hope. So we are causing all of this destruction on the planet, but we're doing it without an awareness that we are something like a planetary dimension. As we take that in, as we fully appreciate that the human species amounts to a recoding of the planet, then we can begin to make decisions that take into account the whole of the planet and not just our national interests or our cultural interests. That movement from seeing ourselves as, say, Americans or French, you know, or Pakistani, seeing ourselves as a dimension of the planet, that is the move of the human species into a new phase of our development.
I told you that I keep your book, The Universe is a Green Dragon, on my poetry shelf. The other books are on the science shelf, but it's on the poetry shelf, and between Rilke and Yeats. And the reason is that book is so evocative. When I read it, it creates in me a sense of awe and wonder at the universe that every time I read it, the creative juices just flow in me.
It's so great to hear, Michael.
And I want everyone to read this book, but and watch the videos. But one of the essential components of this shift and creating this awareness is that place of awe and curiosity and wonder that you talk about. So can you talk about that in an evolutionary sense?
Yeah, I absolutely can. as a way of expressing gratitude to my great teacher. The book, Green Dragon, was written after I encountered this really deeply wise person, Thomas Berry. He has been the principal teacher of my life. And so I was so overwhelmed by his wisdom that I had to write this little book, Universe is a Green Dragon. But what's so funny is that I remember like a year or two after I'd written it, he asked what I was doing, and I was talking about whatever book I was writing. And he laughed. He said, don't bother. You're all done. You wrote the Universe of the Green Dragon. You don't need to do anything else. So I just loved that so much. His sense was that, which I tried to explore there, his sense was that until the human really discovered what it was about, in a deep way, we would continue to destroy the planet. His sense was that we had gotten caught up in a trivial view of what it meant to be human, and by that he meant consumerism. So this drive to just to get things and the material lifestyle, he thought that it was just so beneath us, and that we were destined for something far greater. And for him, that was celebration. And that would be his way of saying, what is the ultimate destiny of the human? The human is, in Thomas's idea, the human is that being in the universe that enables the universe to reflect upon itself and to celebrate its magnificence. I mean, that's it for Thomas. It's everything. So he's speaking in terms of art, but he's also speaking in terms of philosophy, and he's speaking in terms of agriculture. So the idea that to enter into these mysterious processes of the plant world and the soil communities, to be part of that and to know the richness of it, is to celebrate the immense grandeur of the universe. And I remember just reflecting on this and just wondering about it. And then I had this great moment of which I've already attempted to say to you, Michael, and I'm just now responding to your question of how to express some of this in terms of the evolutionary story. I was studying evolution, and I was kind of fascinated with the idea that the brain increased, not in every lineage, but certainly with the vertebrates. There is this long 500 million year development of the brain. I just thought, wow, this is fabulous. This shows kind of what the universe values. But the moment came when I was looking at the early development of the brain in the fish. And, you know, the fish brain is actually way more diverse than the brains of mammals. There's a much wider diversity back then. And so I became really fascinated by it. And then the moment came when I realized that I was fascinated because I had this immense human brain, and I was reflecting on these fish. But then it hit me that it was the fish that gave birth to the nervous system that ultimately became my brain. So that I was a further development of the fish, reflecting on the development of the fish, an illumination moment within the evolutionary context of wonder that's so intense, you really cannot continue to function as just one little isolated being, but you suddenly feel yourself blasted out to become this whole gigantic venture of the universe. You feel like you're just suspended in space, and you realize that you are a moment when all of that comes into awareness of itself and of its deep mystery. Moments like that are moments of wonder that are now available to us in a very particular way to us in this generation that weren't available really in the past, because we had no idea of these billions of years of development. So it's what I'm trying to celebrate here is that this terrible destruction that's taking place on the planet is happening simultaneous with an opportunity to understand ourselves in a cosmic and evolutionary way that was not possible previously. And I think there's almost a simultaneity of the terror and of the beauty. and that somehow this is wrapped up in the mystery of our moment.
It's really overwhelming sometimes to comprehend our part in the unfolding story. And something that you said, or perhaps it was Thomas Berry, that was very simple, but it struck me like a lightning bolt. And that was that we're a star's way of looking at itself, of seeing itself. And I think you related it to many other things. And I certainly have, whether it's the moon or trees or any, particularly in nature, seeing that. And as you talk about the fish, the same kind of process. Wow. My skeletal system came to me from there. And when we're looking back at these things, it's so overwhelming. And yet, it's so clear. And one of the things that you talked about, I thought that was very useful in that, in an evolutionary sense, is the acquisition of free energy. I wonder if you would talk about that in terms of the whole 14 billion year layout of that and how that has had a part in the evolution, but also in terms of the new place that we're moving into, the new story, how that plays in.
Yeah, I'd love to. Give me a sense of, like, what angle on free energy would you enjoy talking about?
Yeah, it is an awfully big subject.
That's a big one.
Well, first of all, the concept itself of free energy, because people might be thinking of turning salt water into new cars or something. So I'm not talking about anything like that. I'm talking about how we evolved and the growth of the species that leads to a place where nowhere in history has there ever been a time where we are responsible for the future. The human race is. That hasn't been the way it's been. It's been an acquisition of free energy all along. But now we're at this place where we're killing, I don't remember how many species a year are dying as a result of our actions. And we have become such a powerful force. We acquired big jumps in energy, of course, when we moved to horticulture, agriculture, and then, of course, with coal and oil, gave us a huge jump, but also a great destructive force. Now, what I'm looking at is in the future, where do you see this acquisition? How do you see that? Because it looks to me like we're going to have to create an entire new relationship, not only with the earth, but with all life, all species, all plants, in terms of that free energy.
Yeah, okay, good.
A long answer, but...
No, I appreciate it because it's such a... I think it's probably the central question. The question of energy is... It's really the central question of our time. And just to bring it into 2008, a lot of people are convinced that's why we're in this war in Iraq. It's all about energy and oil. And so to reflect on these questions, I think, is... to be entertaining the most important questions we can ask. Just to get at the word free energy, it's a scientific word, free energy. It just means energy that is useful, so that it's energy that can be drawn in and then used for something that is helpful to the organism. And one way to understand the whole evolutionary story is that it is the story of the acquisition of free energy for survival on the planet. There's so many different ways of acquiring energy. The most important is photosynthesis. So all these plants are acquiring their energy directly from the sun. And then there's the herbivores, the animals that eat the plants. Okay, then we come to the human, and we not only eat plants and other animals, but we also draw in their energy in different forms. So for instance, we use animals to drive our plows, right? And then we went further. We use the rivers to, spin our wheels. And so it's this growth of the ability to identify and draw in energy. And then it went further, and we developed ways of drawing the energy out of the earth, okay, and the oil and so forth. And then we imitate the plants. With photovoltaic cells. And then most recently, we found a way to actually draw the energy out of the atom. I mean, it's just, the human species is just so amazing. So that all of the various energy sources that we know about in the universe, we have learned to draw forth. We've even learned to draw forth fusion with the hydrogen bomb. I mean, not in a way that's controlled or productive. But we've so mastered this that at the present time, we are drawing in something like 60% of all of the energy of the planet. It's all being drawn into the human project. And in a certain sense, this has to be seen as a success, because this is what every species was trying to do. So, the culmination, if you like, of a long lineage of organisms learning to find energy. But the difficulty, of course, is that we're tearing apart the ecosystems by doing this. And so, current estimates are that if China completely matches the United States in terms of our acquisition of free energy, we will need another couple planets to continue. It's just become so ludicrous. So China and India and the rest of the world cannot be like Americans. And really, Americans cannot be like Americans. So this, we see that there's something about an end to this long journey. Now, the question I ask is this. Does this mean that we have to go against the drive of evolution? It is about the acquisition of free energy. And my suggestion is that, no, we actually are in the middle of another evolutionary advance. It isn't an increase in the amount of energy we draw into our nation, United States, or into our species, Homo sapiens, but rather it's a realization that there are different dimensions to energy, that energy is not simply physical, but energy has a psychic dimension. This move, then, I think is at the core of our advance. If we simply continue to try to acquire just physical energy, we're going to increase the destruction. But what does it mean to move forward by drawing in more of the psychic dimension of energy? So in order to speak about that, I have to say that this is a fundamentally different orientation. Is energy just physical, or is it also psychic? Is it spiritual? Is it psychological? This would move us out of the modern period, because in the modern world, we regarded matter and energy as just physical. But now, it seems as if this view of seeing it as also spiritual makes sense. Because look, like I say, 14 billion years ago, the entire universe, the entire known universe, was in a little tiny speck. We can imagine that as a very intense particle of light in matter. And then it expands out into all of this complexity, part of which is the human species. So that if we have a spiritual dimension, then it seems to me viable to imagine that from the very beginning there was a spiritual dimension. And so that we are seeing in the 14 billion year evolution of the universe, we're seeing a physical evolution, we're seeing a psychic evolution, an emotional evolution. All of these different dimensions are happening simultaneously. So if that assumption begins to take hold of humans, that there is this emotional and psychic dimension to energy, then what would it mean to say that we have a new challenge of acquiring energy? And my suggestion here is that there is a reservoir of energy that surrounds us that we can tap into, that we can draw into our lives, and that it can fill us with this enthusiasm and zest for life. But that the first step has to be to overcome a prejudice, the prejudice that the rest of the universe is actually just physical. But as we begin to imagine these other dimensions, then we have the possibility of swimming in an ocean of energy that leads to a vibrant and fulfilling life. So that what I'm suggesting is that our movement into the future will be a movement that includes an evolution of consciousness, so that we begin to feel that simply to enter into a forest is to enter into a domain of energy that fills us with a sense of completion and joy and satisfaction, and that weans us away from our addiction to a consumer lifestyle. So that switch from consumerism, like piling up commodities, to a deeper participation, the psychic energies of the universe, that switch, I think, is a switch that moves us from a period of destruction and warfare into a period of a more richer and more satisfying participation in the magnificence of what surrounds us.
Wow.
a long answer, but I feel
it. Wonderful answer. Just, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you mean we're going from shopping to collective seeing the deeper wisdom in the unfolding of the universe?
That's exactly it. I mean, it was so sad after 9/11 when President Bush, he was attempting to say something meaningful, and he said, he was talking about the terrorists, and he said, they're trying to stop us from our buying, and they're trying to stop us from our flying. So that it was the idea that shopping and flying around in airplanes, that was the core of our civilization. And so what I'm trying to suggest is just what you said, is that as we learn how to move into, you know, the soul of the universe and the soul of the forest and the ocean, and we are enlivened by the stories of this journey from others, then all of us together begin to participate in a kind of like a great festival of consciousness, and where we're thrilled by the different cultural avenues into the celebration. Like, we're hungry then for the other forms of music and of art from around the planet, recognizing that all of this will deepen our own joy.
One of the things in your video series, Earth's Imagination, that I found very empowering is your conversation about macrophase wisdom and the opportunity that stands at this particular point in time to move towards a place of a comprehensive compassion.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that? I think that's a really important piece of the work here.
If I have anything to offer, that'd be the that would be it, I think. I mean, what I learned from Thomas Berry was that we can take the universe as revelatory. And he was talking now about, this is a man, Thomas Berry, who studied really all of the cultural traditions of the planet. And so he knows, you know, the Hindu spiritual path, and he knows the Christian spiritual path, and Islamic, and all of it. And he was saying that as valuable as all of the sacred scriptures are, and as valuable as all of the sacred writings, you know, theologians and so forth, all of that is extremely important. But he said what's of primary value is the universe itself, is nature itself, and its revelation of ultimacy. And his idea was that we need to learn to find guidance from the universe itself. And I just found that just so attractive. His idea is that we need to attend to the rivers and attend to all of the other animals and plants, and to learn directly from them what we are to be about. What does it mean to be human, and why are we here? And his sense is that all of them are speaking to us, not in English or French, but they're speaking directly by their lives and their life processes. And so I took that very seriously, and in my study of the universe, I've always been looking for indications of how the universe is attempting to express what it values and what it is about. First, one of the most massive discoveries is that the universe is about complexity. So I mentioned that in our current understanding, that the universe we see around us at its beginning 14 billion years ago, it began as light and elementary particles, and then it complexified into atoms and galaxies, and then some living planets like ours, and all this advanced civilization. And so it took 14 billion years. But from the point of view of physicists, this is a very short time. How could all of this happen with just random collisions of atoms? And so one of the things we've come to realize is that the universe from the beginning is biased. It's biased in particular directions. And one of them, the one I'm indicating here, is that it's biased in the direction of complexity. All right, so that's great. So within that complexity, I thought, what are some other biases or inclinations or directions that the universe is expressing by its long history. One that I found so fascinating, and it wasn't a discovery by me by any means. It's something that every evolutionary scientist knows well, and that is the emergence of bonding and then more complex bonding among the animals. And I just found this, I was so riveted by this, so that in early life forms, a cell will replicate, and there seems to be very little bonding between the mother cell and the daughter cell. But as you go forward, you get to this point among the fish where there is this incredible relationship. The parent fish actually will protect their offspring. And this wasn't the way among the fish originally. I mean, the earliest fish, when their offspring came forth, they ate them. It was like another form of food. But then there is this mutation event where at least one species of fish began to protect its offspring. And they would do this to it for a certain period of time, and then they would disappear. And then so the fish evolved into the amphibians and the reptiles, and then the reptiles, they extended this care of the young. They would protect them for even a longer period of time. And then the reptiles evolved into the mammals, and then this care extended even further. So then you have a mother mammal that will actually stay in a bonded relationship with its offspring for an entire lifetime. Now, over the 500 million years then of this development from the fish up into the mammals, you have a spread of what can be called concern or care to wider circles. And then you have this amazing creature come forth called the human. And we come out of 500 million years of vertebrate evolution. So it's very easy for us to care about our offspring because that was all developed in the past. And it's very easy for us to care about our parents and our siblings. But then this amazing development comes forth called the human imagination. And with the human imagination, we not only can care for our offspring and our close relatives, but we can imagine ourselves in the point of view of another species that we are only distantly related to. Like, for instance, whales. I mean, our common ancestor with whales goes back of many, many tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of years. I'm not exactly sure how far back, but it's way, way, way in the past. And yet, look how much we can care about whales. Why? Because we can imagine what it must be like to be a whale. You know, the great anthropologist and writer, Lauren Isley, has an extended meditation on this power, and it's just so fabulous. He is talking about journeys that have been taken by the human species, and then he talks about going to the moon and all of that, but then he comes to this moment when he says, the greatest journey ever taken by the human species was into the feelings of that chasm. And he has this great line. He says, until a human sees himself reflected in the eye of another species, he hasn't yet taken the great journey that is possible for the human. And so I just now speculating then on the universe and wondering what it wants and what it's guiding us toward, I'm simply saying that one way to interpret the 500 million years of a spread of concern among vertebrates is to see in the human a culmination of this, where now the next step is not done genetically by an increase of concern, but it's done through our imagination. Where suddenly we actually can be a center of concern for everything in existence, even for mountains, even for rivers. It's not even life. It's more even beyond life. It's anything we can become profoundly concerned about. And I think this might be a direction that the human is evolving toward.
I should hope so. That's an amazing process. It kind of leaves us with, well, I guess we are the, from now on, the heart and the mind of at least the earth, if not the universe, in a way. I mean, if you look at from that evolutionary kind of progression, being so much a part of it, we are that because we have this huge power now to destroy or to create through our imagination. We're almost to the end. I wish we had a few more hours, Brian. But the one thing I did want to say to help people find a path, a way, and that is, can you just for a minute or two talk about the role of fascination and allurement as you talk about, because, and that whole manifestation of going deeper into what you love as a path rather than a knowledge path or a path of separation and breaking things down to understand them, but a path of that, the wholeness of giving yourself to what you love.
I would love to. The path of allurement, I've really gone into this in detail in my last DVD series called Powers of the Universe. So this would be one of the powers of the universe, allurement or attraction. And one way to think about it is that just go back to the moment when the first galaxies are forming. Now this took place a billion years after the birth of the universe, and suddenly the galaxies are shaping. They're coming forth. Now, what's amazing is that even though some really brilliant humans have focused on this, we have not yet determined how exactly the galaxies came into existence. Now, which means only that it's an extremely complex process, and we will eventually be able to articulate that, but I just want to emphasize the fact that it is so complex, so beyond even the power of the human mind to name yet. So I like to think of this then as the universe acting as a whole. It isn't just that the parts are involved. The parts are involved, yes, but the universe as a whole is involved everywhere. And anytime anything happens, it's particular things in interaction, and it's the whole of the universe itself involved as well. So that, go back now to that moment when the galaxies are forming. What we do know is that it began with clouds of hydrogen and helium. So you have all of these atoms of hydrogen and helium, and they are moving in a way that's going to give birth to the galaxies. How are they moving? What we say is that they are being drawn together by gravity. So if you're a hydrogen atom, you're on some level drawn in, you're drawn towards these other hydrogen atoms. That would be the first example of allurement, of attraction, so that the universe initiates its action by this attraction. And by the hydrogen, simply by going along with that attraction, enters into a process of immense complexity, giving birth to galaxies. Well, it's the same situation now. The universe is in the midst of giving birth to something new. It's a new era of our planet. It's a new era of our human journey. And so how does the universe penetrate into our lives in multiple ways, but very, very powerfully with the experience of allurement? So we find ourselves drawn to particular people or particular ideas or particular, programs for action or particular career paths. In an ultimate sense, that attraction we feel is not entirely understandable. We can analyze it for sure, but at the very, very bottom, it's the mystery of this power of allurement. And so as we identify what is drawing us forth, we will participate consciously in further activating that power by identifying what it is that draws us, by moving forward with it, by reflecting on it, by allowing our lives to be shaped in a new way, guided by this allurement. We then become the universe itself, shaping something new, something that's never existed before, something I'm sure that will be as magnificent as the galaxies themselves.
Brian, my friend, we have run out of time. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for all our listeners, the work you do, and just the depth of it and the impact it's having on our human family. Thank you, Brian Swim. I look forward to seeing you very soon.
I can't wait, Michael. It's been really, really great. Thanks so much.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5 Nevada City and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rwelistening.net.